Among Books is a show where we talk about reading and more. It's recorded in person at Hilltop Books in Northwest Philadelphia. I'm Stephanie Marudis of Kuvenda Media, and on this episode, I chat with John Lobron. He's the librarian and a social studies teacher at Central High School in Philadelphia. For more about John Lobron, please check out the show notes, where you'll also find a reading list based on our conversation. John Lobron, welcome to Among Books.
Thank you, Stephanie. Thanks for having me. This is lovely.
Yeah, it's a nice day to sit and have coffee and tea together and
talk about books.
Talk about books, because books are the everyday part of your life.
Big time. I work at the library at Central High School. It's called Barnwell Library, named after a gentleman from the late 19th century that gave Central High School a big pile of money and said, if you're going to be a legitimate college prep institution, you need a library and you'll have to come and visit.
I would love to.
Barnwell Library is the epicenter of learning at Central High. It's an academic magnet school, meaning it attracts young people that have a vision of themselves going on to higher education. So the young people commute mostly on SEPTA. Plenty of them get rides to school, of course. But we have young people from all over the city, literally from every corner of the city. So that's 2,400 students. You can use the library before school, after school, and during your lunch. So throughout the day, in total, we'll host anywhere from 300 to 400 kids. You know, not every kid's like burning with desire to get into the library every day, but there are a number of regulars who come in and read, do their homework, take a nap, look at their device, of course.
Yes.
Catch up on their shows, play their video games. I only have two simple rules, Stephanie. No food and be quiet. Inside voices.
It's a big space too, right? You told me 25,000 volumes?
We have a decent collection. Fiction, nonfiction, poetry. We have a great poetry collection. And research. Once in a while, I'll say to a young person, aside from providing a kind of safe place for everybody in the school, faculty, students, staff, I provide research instruction to anybody, all comers. So, for example, you're an English teacher.
Okay.
And I'll try to get with every English teacher that teaches ninth graders. And that way we have everybody covered with at least essential ethics of online access to information. What is ethics? Academic ethics, information science ethics, internet usage, protecting your personal information. And then I'll get into how to access academic databases. There's always been an emphasis on ethics. What is your reasoning here? Like, what are you studying? Why are you studying it? And how are you going to use it? And how are you going to share your research findings with your audience?
Yeah.
Like, we'll show you how to do the research, how to find sources, how to cite your sources, how to paraphrase, works cited, proper format, depending on your discipline, right? So we'll teach all that.
So you teach research instruction. How do you learn about research instruction? What do you read?
Excellent.
To know that, to pass on?
I talk to people at the Free Library of Philadelphia. They're youth librarians. And I know people that work and study at University of Penn, Temple University, Arcadia University, CCP, the City University of New York, of course. And I try to just, in a formal and informal way, chat with these people the way we are now.
Yeah.
They're professors of different disciplines. Some of them are library staff. And I kind of keep my hand on the pulse of what's expected of a college kid. And then I bring that back to Central and try to translate it into, well, you know, these kids are accustomed to digital access. So we only have access to about three academic databases. The rest of them we get through going through the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Yeah.
Are you ready for this?
Okay.
140 databases. Free Library of Philadelphia.
I know. It's amazing.
Now, mind you, of those 140, there's probably about a solid 12 or 13 that are designed for college-bound high school kids, mm-hmm. right? Most of them are public access, getting your driver's license, your driver's permit, health information, unemployment, the Commonwealth, the City of Philadelphia, mm-hmm. federal entities. But there's also a lot of early literacy mm-hmm. databases, mm-hmm. learning a second language or a world language, mm-hmm. a ton of resources, which is great for our kids because mm-hmm. a lot of them are responsible. I call them kind of like extra familial responsibilities. Beyond being a teenager and doing your chores and contributing to your household, a lot of these kids do have to help their parents pay the bills,
yes.
deal with immigration paperwork, taxes. A lot of family businesses lean on the teenagers to do the business end of stuff. So I do a lot with the free library, just making sure the kids know this is where you access information. Homelessness is an issue. Mm. Domestic abuse, sadly, the criminal justice system. So all these are accessible, legitimate sources of information via the free library. So to bring it back to helping young people learn how to access research, it's beyond you're going to college, you need to know how to cite sources properly and use them in formal academic writing. It's also just daily life. We yeah. want you to be an informed citizen. We want you to be autonomous. How do you find legitimate information? To bring it back to your question, I'm just constantly, like yourself, like you're trying to be a better podcaster every chance mm-hmm. you get. I'm trying to be a better librarian. Mm. Just talk to people, read sources from different professional journals and whatnot.
As a librarian, what does the librarian read? What is your reading diet like? I mean, in your personal...
As an individual?
Yeah, personal life.
That's an interesting question. I've never been good at drawing the line between my professional career and my individual interest. It comes and goes. I read a lot of fiction, contemporary works, classics that I haven't read. Read one or two of those a year. So as an individual, it's quite diverse, just fiction, though, mostly. Nonfiction comes out of a couple news sources on the daily. But other than that, I don't read much nonfiction. The lines blur because I teach history through literature. And so if I'm expecting my kids to read a work of historical fiction, which is a huge genre of fiction, of literature, if I'm expecting students or the whole class to read a work of historical fiction, I need to read it.
Yes.
For example, Colson Whitehead wrote The Underground Railroad. And as soon as I saw a review of it somewhere, I was like, whoa, that might be a good work of literature for my History Through Literature program. And I grabbed the copy and I read that. Mm. And I'll take prolific notes on it. Mm. A concrete example of what I'm reading right now, where it's both personally enlightening and enjoyable read, is a title about the colonial experience. The setting is in Jamestown, Virginia. The title is The East Indian by Brenda Shari. It's a novel set in Jamestown, but it introduces students to different significant historical themes, the concept of race, bigotry, the practical nature of the economy in colonial America, specifically slavery, how slavery worked, the transatlantic slave trade, the tobacco industry, the British Empire, and maybe the difference between indentured servitude. So this concept of historical literature to open the door to some rather difficult topics and themes in history that need to be covered more than ever among our young people. They need to be at least familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of my personal reading is getting ready for work and delivering ideas about the historical experience of different groups of people in American history via literature.
I see.
Yeah.
Do you feel that they respond differently to the topics and issues that when you teach it through literature as opposed to you just getting up and giving a lecture?
I think the lecture, getting back to analog and traditional, let's call it, I think there is a place to give a rough outline, chronology, major themes, geography, but then letting the kids loose, and whether it's a short story or a poem or a piece of literature, now they have sort of the parameters.
I see.
They have a rough idea of the background, the historical and cultural background. And to answer your question directly, yes, I think it's one of the greatest characteristics of authentic study of history is developing a sense of empathy and compassion for other groups of people, or maybe your own people, your own ancestors went through a certain phenomena that you weren't familiar with. And so through this literature, I think it does help create a greater sense of consciousness.
It's fascinating. I mean, I think that reading has this role. We know when you're a student of history, you can study primary sources and secondary sources. And then the beautiful thing about historical fiction is it does all that for you. And also, I guess, unpacks the narrative in a way that perhaps for some might feel more accessible.
I like your language, more accessible. It's non-threatening. Now, I have a paucity of titles about the colonial experience, to be honest with you. But as far as like the antebellum South, multiple titles, post-Civil War, industrialization, immigration, urbanization, westward expansion, I have a ton of titles. And so what I can do is I have a short list of titles and I'll give the kids the short list. I'll say, hey, look at the New York Times reviews, The Atlantic. Just go to Goodreads. You could go to Amazon and read some decent book reviews, critiques, brief synopses of the title, the background, a little bit about the author. And the kids are able to make their own decision about what they want to read.
Yeah.
And that, what you were just saying about this idea of accessibility and autonomy, a developmental domain at this age that reading helps us with is autonomy. What do I want to read? Why do I want to read it?
I don't have the precise research or data in front of me, but I do want to go here with you about where we are in terms of our reading habits as a society. And, you know, some say we read less than we once did. And for young people in particular, who might be filling their free time with different choices than reading, if we can talk a bit about, from your perspective, we can celebrate the virtues of reading because that's part of this podcast. But what you see, especially for young people, what it can do for them. And maybe that's part of your role too, implicitly or explicitly, to share with them.
Yeah, I mean, as a librarian, it's a major responsibility to cultivate a love of reading, to share your own love of reading and maybe a societal value placed on reading. And it's a struggle. But I'm happy to say I'm able to keep our collection of fiction fresh, contemporary. So predominantly girls will come in and know what they want. They want, yes, romances, adventures, sci-fi is pretty hot among boys and girls. Nonfiction, I'm happy to report to you, philosophy, religion, identity, gender issues, ethnic studies, cultural studies. You know, don't forget, America is more and more multi-ethnic. They'll have parents from two distinct cultures, like distinct histories. But who am I? So this has always been a prerogative for young people to figure out. I love my parents. I respect my parents. But I don't know about X way of their life. I'm starting to question that, right? So how much of my parents' and my ancestors' values will I hold on to and embrace myself? And how much of it can I maybe put aside and replace? But what am I going to replace those values with? I heard about some other interesting ideas. And that's why frequently I'll find kids in those 100s, 200s, 300s of the Dewey Decimal System. Sorry to geek. Sorry to geek out on you like that, but they need to find the book. So let's go back to autonomy. Okay, we have our catalog. It's an online public access catalog. We have access to more knowledge than ever before in humankind. Internationally, national libraries, university collections, different cultural and economic and legal institutions. So we follow that mold by making our catalog accessible, of course. And so when a kid comes up to me, he's like, hey, you have any books on X topic? I'll be like, I don't know. Let's look at the catalog. So they learn how to use an online public access catalog of our collection. And then I walk into the stacks with them. And I'm going to say easily, we have a significant number of kids that come in and want to borrow a book. Predominantly fiction, but plenty of nonfiction also. Economics is another big topic. A lot of them just started working, 16, 17-year-olds. They're not sure about how to read their pay stub, which they can go find online. But a lot of the kids want a greater understanding of economics. And so we have a decent collection on economics, constitutional law. And on a personal level, sometimes kids are involved in a justice system and they want to know not just what their constitutional rights are, but just like the practice of law, what's acceptable and what's not. So I'm happy to report, and I'm sorry to be so anecdotal about it, plenty of young people still read. But to be fair, I mean, I'm in an academic magnet school.
That was going to be my follow-up
so
point.
So there's a propensity for students of that ilk seeking knowledge, whether it's analog or digital. They're curious young minds, and they want to understand how things are working.
We're going to take a short break now from our conversation and turn it over to Amy Wilson. She's the executive director of the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library and manager at Hilltop Books, where we record the show.
We're a used bookstore run on book donations, so it's volunteer staffed, open 6 days a week, and it's run by the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library. All of the books in the store are just a third of the retail price on the book. Proceeds from our sales benefit the Chestnut Hill Library. So we support programs at the library, we support the book collections, and we also help out with building maintenance and advocate for the library system as a whole. We love volunteers. There's a range of volunteer opportunities, from working in the store to helping us with pop-ups and special events. And our volunteer intake form is on our website.
For more about Hilltop's hours, location, and volunteer opportunities, log on to hilltopbooks.org. Let me ask you, why did you decide to become a librarian after you had been a longtime teacher?
Wow, that's a great question. I always loved libraries. As a matter of fact, before I was doing, I started off in literacy. I don't know if you want the long answer, but
I'd love to hear that. Yeah.
Okay. My work study job at Temple University many moons ago was I worked for the Temple University Press, which is their book publishing house. And the lady that ran the business department ran a community education program in North Philadelphia. And she invited me to teach one of her classes one night. And I was introduced to teaching what we call teaching English to speakers of other languages, or a kind of archaic phrase is English as a second language. And I did that. And I started doing it weekly. And it just felt right. Teaching just felt really good to me. I felt like it was meaningful. People were motivated. People responded with a lot of positive energy, and it just made me feel great. So I worked in literacy for a good 3 or 4 years after college, Center for Literacy. I did workplace literacy for working people during their lunch break for a nonprofit called the Lutheran Children and Family Services. Yeah. The Center for Literacy is another Philadelphia-based nonprofit. Dropout literacy. I did that for 2 years among high school dropouts. And then basically I needed a job that was going to pay better. So I found a job with the School District of Philadelphia as a teacher of history and Spanish. So reading and ideas that we find in books has always been a love of mine. I should attribute some of that causation to my mom, who loved the library. We would go to the library regularly.
All the time, huh?
So it was a big part of my youth growing up. So after teaching for 20 years in the classroom every day, I found out about an opportunity through the federal government's Office of Library and Museums. And Laura Bush was the first lady. Her emphasis, sort of the way Michelle Obama's emphasis was on nutrition and raising children's consciousness about their physical welfare, things they eat, their exercise. Okay, Laura Bush's thing was reading and libraries. And this grant was published for, you had to be a school teacher for at least 10 years. You had to agree to stay in the public school library for another 5 years. And they would give you, I got a graduate degree in library and information studies from Drexel University with a grant from the federal government. I didn't pay a dime. Well, except for books and transportation and whatnot. I know, right? So, like I said, now, even before I became the librarian at Central, I was always bringing my kids to the library. And this is where the bridge between analog and digital happened during my teaching career. So I would bring my kids in and show them how to start a research project, the general encyclopedia, then a specialized encyclopedia. Then we go into the stack. So I was no stranger to using the library as an instructional tool, as a primary part of your methodology and of your pedagogy. So I was just pretty much, to answer your question, I was given this lucky break. And then just as I was finishing my graduate degree, the librarian at Central retired and the president of the school asked me to step in. And that was roughly 10 years ago now, Stephanie.
Oh, wow.
So I consider myself sort of like the luckiest man alive, to borrow a phrase from Lou Gehrig. Really, quite fortunate. I meet so many interesting young people with a variety of, in the parlance of librarians, library studies. User needs are cover a broad span of the human experience. You know, very practical stuff all the way through, hey, can you help me find a work of poetry? I've never really read poetry. So this is like a 15-year-old. And I would be like, well, like, what's on your mind? Why are you coming in here today? So you're trying to narrow down the kid's search. What are you looking for? And so the kid just said, well, every day I'm on the bus and I'm passing these guys that are homeless. And I'm like, why? How is this? What is happening? Why do I feel this way? How do they feel? And I just said, here, just browse poetry. And he found something and it helped him find peace with some aspect of the human condition. I don't know what it is. This is in a high school library. Like all day long, different kids have different inquiries.
You know, you mentioned your mother being the one who cultivated this love of the library and taking you there. Where did you grow up, John?
I grew up at the northern edge of Philadelphia County in Montgomery County in a neighborhood called Melrose Park, which is literally a block north of Cheltenham Avenue in Cheltenham Township, which is what we call now the older suburbs. My mom was Catholic, so we went to Catholic schools for 12 years. But the public library, I was there throughout my childhood through elementary school.
What did you like to read as a young reader?
Oh, man. I mean, obviously, Curious George. Easy. Easiest question you asked all day. Curious George, I remember going through biographies written for children, right? There was a whole series of them. Thomas Alva Edison, Ben Franklin, Amelia Earhart. I mean, ask me any question about any of these guys. Henry Ford, of course. And then as I got older, my dad used to get National Geographic.
Sure.
It was the only magazine we got at our house. He loved it. He had been in the service, and I think, I don't know, he just seemed like very worldly, quiet man, but really worldly and thoughtful. And he would get that National Geographic and tear through it, and I'd be the next one in. And so what this did was broaden my interest in maritime, the seas, oceanography, geography, different cultures around the world, of course. National Geographic is such a beautiful publication. So that was a big part of my youth, my interest. And then probably, I don't know when I really started reading fiction, probably in high school.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a lot of nonfiction to start, more so, and then transitioning into fiction.
I spent some time traveling. and meeting different kinds of people and stepping out of that one neighborhood and that one cultural milieu that I grew up in. And it was quite eye-opening. And I don't think I was even reading for a while. Oh, I lived and worked in Ireland for a couple of years. And I remember being there and reading The Hobbit. I loved, of course, Hemingway, Steinbeck. That's just a few people that come to mind.
And we'll put some titles in the show notes for listeners to check out.
I didn't mention Melville or 2 Years Before the Mast by Richard Dena. Classic. That had such a heavy influence on me about a young man that leaves Boston and goes around Cape Horn.
We're going to come back to that because I do want to ask you about some of the influential books. Before we do get to the final question, is there anything that you want to talk about that we haven't touched on?
I don't like to use militaristic terms, but we have a battle going on right now for our children's minds. There's teachers, parents who are concerned, people that really know what's going on out here right now, psychologists, developmental experts, medical practitioners that now have empirical evidence of the devolution of our children's minds. There's different pop culture phrases for it. Brain rot, the onset of brain rot. It's a battle going on. I see this, and it's anecdotal with me, but there is empirical evidence now, much of it referenced by the Surgeon General, who has put out a warning to parents, especially teachers, any caregivers for children, and people we're talking about in my context, teenagers need to be conscious of looking out for their own mental health, their mental welfare in every regard, their emotional welfare, their spiritual welfare, and intellectually, how much assistance do you really need? You could process a lot of this on your own with paper and pencil, then search. And so reading, the act of finding a book in a library, using a catalog, going to the stacks, finding the right shelf, alphabetical order, alphanumerical order. These are things our children learned in their childhood that have been taken away from them. And now, with empirical evidence, we're seeing a decline in reading. It's true. Again, I don't know if either one of us have those numbers in front of us right now, but there's been a decline in reading such that, if I could reference this one work, an opinion piece in the New York Times, a professor from a pretty elite university suggesting that he was having a hard time. These are ambitious young people seeking out degrees in higher education who can't read a book and annotate a book the way 10 years ago was baseline, like rote behavior. Oh, let me annotate the main highlights of this book so I can participate in class and talk about it. Whether it's a chapter in a piece of fiction, piece of poetry, nonfiction, you have college professors teaching children how to read that they should have been taught in 6th, 7th, 8th grade because of an over-reliance on digital technology in the classroom. And then, come on, in general, in society, the average teenager is using a digital device 5 to 9 hours a day, Stephanie?
Yeah.
Okay, so physiologically, psychologically, intellectually, the use of books is a way for us as individuals to seek out a better understanding of the universe and our place in it. Not be spoon-fed, not be influenced, and ideally through this process, as part of your education, to pick up books and read on your own terms, without being told what to read or how to read it, maybe with some guidance, you can become a better, fuller self and achieve your self-identity at an appropriate age.
There's a fundamental shift going on per this topic of how reading is taught, and in some cases, full books aren't taught anymore. It's excerpts of books. And we could have a debate, you know, pros and cons of the approach, but there seems to be a collective lament over the inability to read a full book at a collegiate level.
True, yes.
So
it's a thing. And so in my work as a librarian, as a teacher, I'm just trying to push books every chance I get. Some of my peers might criticize me because it's not a real history class if you're using fiction. Au contraire. Mm-hmm. I feel like one of the greatest takeaways from learning history is empathy for what different groups of people have gone through, and it contributes to a sense of pluralism and your own identity and a respect for differences and how it makes us all stronger people being familiar with one another. So every chance I get, I'll push the use of a book.
Well, on that note, we were going there a little bit earlier, but what are the books that have had an impact on you, John? Not all of them, but some of them that might have influenced the way you think, live, and act in the world.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, obviously the Bible, Scripture, my ability to compare and contrast Scripture from Judeo-Christian culture with Quranic Scripture, Indian cultures, Native American cultures. So works of religion I've read. So beyond the Quran and the Bible, works from Eastern Asia and Buddhism and Hinduism. In terms of philosophy, I'm heavily influenced by the Socratic method, Socrates, Aristotle, classics of Western culture, I guess I should say. I read significant amount of nonfiction and methodology and pedagogy and get ready to teach. I try to stay on top of that as time goes on. In terms of fiction, works by Melville, Billy Budd, Ford Topman, I think it is. One of the greatest short stories I ever read in my life. Steinbeck, The Pearl. I can tell you, really made an impression on me. There's one scene, if I could, just real
please,
quick,
please.
Where Kino, he's a pearl fisherman on the west coast of California, Baja California. He's indigenous. So all these poor indigenous pearl divers go out every day, and he pulls out this magnificent pearl, and he brings it to the local pearl shop. But he looks around the shop, and he knows these shopkeepers are going to rip him off. But he looks around anyway. He looks at his peers in their ragged dress and what have you, and their downcast demeanor. He's like, you know, these people were just doing the best they could with what they had. So when I interact with kids today, with adults, I have a great sense of empathy. You don't really know what people are going through.
No, you don't.
And I got that. I mentioned Scripture already, but also Steinbeck tells it in so many different ways. I would like to tell you that Grapes of Wrath had a big impact on me, such that for some time I worked with the United Farm Workers of America.
Okay.
But talk about historical fiction. I mean, the Grapes of Wrath, it's the whole story of the destructive physical force of nature during that time period and migration.
Absolutely.
So I mentioned 2 years before The Mast, The Hobbit, of course. Right now I got a thing for Irish fiction, so I've been reading a lot of that. But this is what comes to mind right now. I'm probably leaving out a whole bunch of titles and a whole bunch of authors. But there it is.
Well, John, I want to thank you for joining us on Among Books.
Oh, thanks for having me, Stephanie. I really enjoyed this.
Me too.
Appreciate it.
Among Books is mixed by Brad Linder and produced by me, Stephanie Marutis of Kuvenda Media. And a final special thanks to the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library, its executive director and Hilltop Books manager, Amy Wilson, and the many volunteers who make the day-to-day operation of the bookstore possible. Until next time, happy reading.